Canadians keen to participate in the gathering debate about the Afghanistan war on a more immediate and possibly more meaningful level than simply casting their vote in the next election will find the growing discourse about military reform a subject of interest to them. I call it a discourse because it is more than a debate or a controversy, although it includes many debates and more than one controversy. Criticism of the government's current war by the military has honorable antecedents, especially in the United States. General Omar Bradley, for example, famously criticized the Korean War as the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time. U.S. Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler may be best known today for his slim volume, War is a Racket, published in 1935, but he was also the most decorated Marine at the time, having won 2 Congressional Medals of Honor. War is a Racket is credited as one of the first works to describe the military-industrial complex, later described and criticized by General Dwight Eisenhower. The discourse about military reform has a history, a cast of characters and organizations, along with a substantial and growing list of texts and issues. It is both academic and down-to-earth, strategic and tactical, theoretical and practical. It has a vocabulary of its own and examples in the real world, some of which are almost traditional, others must be understood as experiments. As I think you will see when this broadcast unfolds, the war in Afghanistan and Canada's role in it are clearly experimental. Neither Shall the Sword, Conflict in the Years Ahead, by Chet Richards, published earlier this year by the Center for Defense Information, the Strauss Military Reform Project, and the World Security Institute, is one of the most recent additions to the literature. At 116 pages, it provides an excellent introduction to current thinking about military reform. Chet Richards is a retired colonel in the U.S. Air Force Reserve, and Neither Shall the Sword is an honest, well-documented, easy-to-understand, carefully reasoned, thought-provoking, and well-written exposition of fourth-generation warfare. Subnational groups attempting to take control of a state are conventional insurgents using guerrilla warfare. Terrorism, Richards defines simply as killing civilians in order to influence their governments or their militaries. Its purpose, he says, is, quote, to turn the victim society inward on itself. By this I mean such things as launching witch hunts, stifling the free flow of information, fostering dissension among the various elements of the society, and instituting costly and disruptive but ultimately ineffective security measures. These measures may also begin to isolate the state from its allies if, for example, it puts in place onerous visa procedures for entry. End quote. 4GW makes use of both insurgency and terrorism, so it must be something else. It is what we see failing in Iraq and possibly in Afghanistan. What is 4GW, Richards asks. The correct answer, he says, is that we don't know for sure because it is still being worked out. It is a war outside the state model. In the West, since the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, wars have been understood to occur between armies that serve nation-states. In among the state versus state conflicts occurring between uniformed armed forces, there were always other groups carrying out armed conflict, criminal gangs, tribes in areas where the state was not strong, and insurgents. It was from these groups, rats, as Richards puts it, among the thundering claws of the dinosaurs, that the next fourth generation of war evolved. End quote. They may use guerrilla warfare or terrorism as tactics. The emergence of non-state political, social, economic, and military networks by which 4GW forces attempt to persuade the state is new. After the disintegration of the Soviet Empire, some U.S. and Soviet client states became breeding grounds for a new type of organization which uses modern technology such as the internet and cell phones to recruit and train members and to plan operations. This new type of conflict is often known by several names. Asymmetrical warfare, non-trinitarian conflict. Richards uses the term fourth generation war, or 4GW. Although ideas for prosecuting 4GW run the gamut from isolationism to an active program of military intervention and regime change, all of these strategies can be lumped into two schools, containment and rollback. The idea of containment is that given time and the right kind of encouragement, people living in areas that host 4GW will get their acts together, throw out their bad rulers, and join the developed world. Containment might entail either retaliation to punish and eliminate the regime that has played host to a 4GW organization, or intervention with intelligence and international police organizations. Although he doesn't mention it specifically, containment has been used to denote the 12-year period of sanctions, inspections, no-fly zones, and air attacks between the first Gulf War and the second. The idea of rollback is to intervene and then to rebuild the failed state so that it can no longer play host to a 4GW enemy. In Richards' words, proponents of rollback generally see the military as an ordinary tool of policy and would use it to break open countries that harbor 4GW groups or that we, for any other reason, feel potentially threaten the security of the developed world. The promise of rollback is great. It would eliminate terrorist groups, world poverty, ignorance, hunger, and disease. The problem with rollback, according to Richards, is equally great. Nobody knows how to do it. Our Iraqi adventure, he says, has discredited the idea of military intervention as the primary mechanism, and other tools of regime change, such as political pressure or economic sanctions, can take decades to work, when they work at all, and they always bring great hardship to ordinary people living in the affected countries. End quote. If we see shock and awe as the intervention phase of a rollback operation, the period after Bush's mission accomplished declaration is the rebuilding and integration. Richards noted elsewhere, just after the London bombings, that, quote, neoconservative commentators are crowing that Iraq's economy has now returned to pre-war levels. In other words, after 2 years of reconstruction, Iraq as a whole has reached the level of an economy decimated by 12 years of UN sanctions and Ba'athist corruption. And even much of this progress is artificial since it reflects an enormous temporary infusion of American dollars. End quote. We have to be wary of similar rhetoric about Afghanistan. It would be a mistake to see Iraq and Afghanistan as examples of the theory Richards is writing about in any sense. The writers here, not only Richards but the ones he draws on, Barnett, Hams, Lind, Scheuer, Van Creveld, are critical of the way these conflicts have been handled. Richards obviously prefers rollback, end terrorism, wipe out poverty, eradicate disease. It sounds almost like the Millennium Development Goals. Few would argue that such a world, if it could be built, would be a worthy goal, Richards concludes. But what if some, if not most, of our efforts to achieve it only turn out like Iraq? At the end, he remembers, quote, an important principle known to all but often disregarded in daily practice. Ends, no matter how alluring, do not justify means. In fact, the more attractive the goals for which we are striving, the more we are tempted to compromise the moral codes that we profess and that others expect us to live by. Noble aspirations do not justify evil. Rather, they are so often a pathway to it. End quote. That's it for this Monday. This report has been archived on Radio for All, where you can get it either as a podcast or in raw MP3 format. To comment or suggest a story, send email to earthling@cjly.net, attention World Report, or snail mail box 767 Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4, Attention World Report. This is Jim Terrell for Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.